Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Kevin Andrews makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute and David Moore makes a welcome first appearance. And the topic is Red, Ted, Theodore and Joseph Lyon's Money, Men and Depression. And we're here on the occasion of the recent launch of The Curse of Mungana by David E. Moore and the recent launch of Kevin Andrews' Joseph Lyon's and the Management of Adversity. I'll introduce our speakers very briefly. David Moore studied at the University of Queensland, qualified in science, got a doctorate in minerals processing, was the 1964 Rhodes Scholar, worked in mining and finance, and then later in his career picked up a PhD with a book, well, what became this book, but the thesis on the three Queensland premiers and the Mungana scandal. So Dr. Moore is really Dr. Moore, so I thought you'd be interested to know that. And Kevin Andrews, well known to all of us, but has been a member of the Australian Parliament since 1991. He serves as a cabinet minister in numerous portfolios, most recently as the Minister for Defence. And Kevin Andrews has written a number of books, contributes to the media regularly and publishes on his own policy magazine. His most recent book before this one was Maybe I Do, Modern Marriage and the Pursuit of Happiness, and most recently this monograph on Joseph Lyon. So we're going to lead off with David Moore, we'll move to Kevin Andrews, and then we'll do questions and discussion. David, you're welcome.
Jared Henderson, ladies and gentlemen, I'm an ageing 77-year-old amateur on my first visit here. Edward Theodore, one of two politicians featured in Australian Financiers, the Reserve Bank's bicentenary biographical essays, was described once as a giant of Labor mythology. But much of his character and career remains enigmatic. Let us examine this further in the context of the Depression era. See if I can get this right now.
Can we ask you to speak into the microphone?
I'll bring the microphone close. Okay, is that better? In 1922, Smith's Weekly described Theodore as follows. The whole Queensland legislature really consists of King George V and King Theodore I. With proxy votes in his pocket, only one legislative chamber, and no punch in the opposition, Theodore I is monarch of Queensland. He is a strange admixture of politician, patriot, statesman, and dictator. He is the sincerest and strongest man who has emerged from the ranks of Labor in a generation. The only thing that will kill Theodore is Theodore himself. That was a very prophetic statement. 1922 proved to be a watershed year, as soon afterwards an unknowingly vulnerable Australia drifted progressively towards recession and the Depression. 9 years later, at age 47, Theodore's 22-year political career came to an abrupt end. In the 15 years after Theodore arrived in the Chiligo area of North Queensland, with the mining industry and trade unionism firmly in his blood, he experienced a meteoric rise. Together with his close friend William McCormack, later the member for Cairns, he co-founded the Amalgamated Workers Association, or the AWA as it was known, and 6 years later orchestrated a reverse takeover of the AWU to create Queensland's powerful political base for the next century. Within 6 years of entering the Legislative Assembly, He was Deputy Premier and Treasurer and became Premier in 1919, just before his 35th birthday. Over the following 3 years, he survived and learned from a major disagreement with British financial institutions, reorganised the judiciary, and finally orchestrated abolition of the Legislative Council. At the peak of his power, he was ready to move to the wider national stage. It would take some time to do this, as the path was much more difficult than he had planned. Theodore, self-taught and a prodigious reader, was clever, ambitious, with a strong entrepreneurial streak, who quickly cultivated high-profile contacts. A large man with a large vision, he was also a powerful orator. He was seen as a person well ahead of his time, exemplified by his 1924 proposal to the Labour Party National Conference for an independent central bank and his support for a centralised loan council. His Central Reserve Bank bill was stalled by the Senate in 1930, but formed the basis of the delayed legislation in 1959. Yet he also had the capacity to cultivate enemies, mixed with his scant recognition of conflicts of interest. To understand Theodore's career, his special relationship with McCormack must be appreciated. Comrades at arms until 1915, they became a powerful duo. Theodore was the brains, McCormack was the brawn. Thereafter, their careers diverged. Following in Theodore's shadow, McCormack finally became Premier just before Theodore lost his bid for the federal seat of Herbert in late 1925. McCormack remained as Premier until the 1929 state election, by which time Theodore was Deputy Federal Leader. After a 14-month wait, in 1927, he was parachuted into the Sydney seat of Daly, under circumstances that were revealed at a 1928 Commonwealth Royal Commission. It concluded that the sitting member was induced to resign by a £5,000 cash payment from parties unknown, widely believed to be the notorious John Wren. Theodore became Deputy Leader after the 1928 federal election and then Treasurer when James Scullin became Prime Minister in the Labor landslide, only days before the stock market crash at Wall Street. Contrary to many people's views, the crash did not precipitate the depression in Australia. The combination of escalating government debts, substantially increased during World War I and continuing thereafter, plus a heavy reliance on Britain for trade and borrowings, made us vulnerable. The seeds here had already been well planted and watered. When in 1925 Britain unwisely reinstated the gold standard at its pre-war level, sterling was overvalued, so it sentenced itself to a long recession. This decision impacted adversely on Australia, which also persisted in retaining parity with sterling until our devaluation in 1930. Vulnerability was exposed when the terms of trade declined due to lower prices for primary exports, while interest rates started to increase. It was a potentially toxic mix that very few people recognised. The prominent economist Sir Leslie Melville believed South Australia was already in depression in late 1928, with all states following suit. In May 1929, it was revealed no new overseas loans could be raised, so expenditure had to be reined in. This was the situation that confronted Theodore at his first loan council meeting as treasurer. You see the bone in the middle of the is all that's left to be split between the states, and that was already in early 1930. Incidentally, Melville, who worked with every treasurer from Earl Page in the 1920s to John Howard in the 1980s, in his audio memoirs nominated Theodore as the most capable of the whole group of treasurers that he worked with. Theodore was soon fighting on two other fronts. His unusual entry into New South Wales Labor politics displeased the powerful Jack Lane, New South Wales Premier, 1925 to 27, and again from 1930 until his dismissal by the Governor in May 1932. The other issue that he had to confront was a relic from his Queensland political days, where his friend McCormack played a key role. On Theodore's recommendation, the loss-making Chiligo smelters in his electorate were acquired by the state in 1918. Following amended legislation in 1920, the state very quickly acquired mining leases at Mungana near Chiligo on a royalty arrangement, unrelated to their intrinsic profitability. Over 6 years, the enterprise produced losses equivalent to $40 million in today's terms and $90 million in funding, greatly increasing the state's deficit. In 1926, McCormack reluctantly admitted to holding a minor equity stake in the Mungana leases, and the opposition called for a royal commission. In 1929, during the federal election campaign, it was revealed that McCormack had consistently lied and was indeed the major shareholder, receiving nearly $1 million in today's terms. This precipitated the Chiligo-Mungana Royal Commission, which reported in 1930, just before Theodore was to deliver his first budget. The bombshell revelation that McCormack had promptly passed on half of his Mungana proceeds to Theodore elevated the scandal to the national stage. The commissioner concluded that McCormack, Theodore and two others were guilty of fraud and dishonesty in procuring the state to purchase the Mungana mines. While a year later, Theodore and McCormack were somewhat surprisingly acquitted of the civil charge of conspiracy, the taint of Mungana remained with Theodore. And this is fully covered in the book you see. The Mungana scandal did not directly cause Theodore's demise. That role lay with Jack Lang and the bitter dispute about how to counter the ravages of the Great Depression. The timing of the Royal Commission report was appalling. Theodore immediately resigned as Treasurer, so never participated in the critical discussions between the Commonwealth, State Premiers and the Bank of England later that month. The politician with the most relevant financial experience and ideas was sidelined at a time when the Prime Minister was also to be absent in Britain for 5 months. His place was taken by Joseph Lyons, former Premier of Tasmania, who became acting Treasurer and supported the agreed deflationary cost reduction actions and balanced budgets known as the Melbourne Agreement. Theodore retreated temporarily to the backbench, pending possible legal action by the Queensland Government. He did not support this totally deflationary approach and returned to public life to oppose the Melbourne Agreement. A final decision was deferred until the Prime Minister returned from Britain in January 1931, when Scullin persuaded Caucus to restore Theodore as Deputy Leader and Treasurer. It helped precipitate a crisis in the Labor Party, already troubled by the activities of Lang, who had recently been re-elected as New South Wales Premier. Lyons resigned and soon left the party. And then this led to the Battle of the Plans. This cartoon shows them all getting ready. Theodore Scullin at the front and Jack Lang looking at the back. February 1931 opened with a public clash between Theodore and Lang at the Premier's Conference. Theodore outlined a somewhat less deflationary Keynesian-style approach, including an $18 million fiduciary note issue, today called quantitative easing, whereas the radical Lang plan included a cancellation of interest payments on overseas debts, which no one else supported. This effectively split the Labor Party, with Lang controlling the party in New South Wales. And to make matters worse, Lyons and several Labor ministers then teamed up with the Nationalist opposition in the new United Australia Party. In 1931, a Premier's plan without the note issue was finally adopted by all governments except New South Wales. It was then Lang versus the rest of Australia, as clearly shown on this cartoon. Throughout the rest of the year, Scullin's government struggled with Lang, and it came as no surprise that late in the year, Lang voted with the opposition and the government fell. At the December election, the Labor Party won only 14 seats. It failed miserably in New South Wales, where Lang won 4 seats. In Delhi, Theodore lost to a Lang Labor candidate and gained less than 20% of the vote. He immediately decided to leave federal politics, where his turbulent career had lasted less than 5 years. Thereafter, Theodore devoted his time to a flourishing business career, teaming up with Frank Packer in late 1932 to found the instantly successful Australian Women's Weekly. He became chairman of Consolidated Press in 1936, a post he held until his retirement in 1949. In 1933, Theodore's association with Packer extended to his favourite mining industry, gold mining in Fiji, with Theodore, managing director, Packer, and believe it or not, John Wren, as equal shareholders in Emperor Gold Mines. In 1935, public flotation of Emperor Gold Mines and the smaller La Loma Gold Mines were heavily oversubscribed. This period witnessed a dramatic enhancement of the increasingly urbane Theodore's business reputation. Consolidated Press and Emperor Mines grew rapidly, returning high profit growth, dividends and capital appreciation. There was no stigma arising from the collapse of his political career. His proven financial acumen, entrepreneurial and management skills had the reverse effect. Not long before Lyons died, he apparently contacted Theodore about a possible return in a non-political role. This is precisely what John Curtin did soon after his appointment as Prime Minister. Theodore became unpaid, for whatever reason, Director General of Allied Works until late 1944, having extraordinarily wide powers. His Allied Works Council spent $80 million and employed 50,000 people during his 2 years stint there. When Theodore died in 1950, he left a significant estate of £528,000, equivalent to around $25 million in today's terms. This brief analysis highlights why it's so difficult to really define King Theodore I. I conclude with a summary by Trevor Sykes from Theodore's Scandal in his book Two Centuries of Panic. Theodore was undeniably a man of great ability. In history, he remains the most compelling of figures, a great man streaked by a flaw. Other great men have had far worse flaws. The real losers were the Australian people, who lost the one man who might have steered them out of the Depression sooner. That flaw was his involvement in the Mungana scandal. So, was he really the best Prime Minister Australia never had? I encourage you all to make your own judgment. Thank you.
Kevin Andrews. Thank you very much, Jared. Can I acknowledge you and David, my State Parliamentary colleague, Peter Phelps, and particularly want to acknowledge Anne Henderson tonight, who's the biographer of Joseph Lyons and whose work on Joseph Lyons is the major work so far as this time is concerned. Obviously, in the time tonight, I can't do justice to the whole biography of Joseph Lyons, so I just want to pick out a couple of things, and I encourage you, if you have time to read Anne's book, and if you don't have time to read the 400-page book, you can read my 70-page monograph. The one constant in the public leadership of Joseph Lyons was the management of debt. From the outset of his parliamentary career in Tasmania, he spoke about the challenge of state debt and about the cost of repaying it. And his constant message throughout his whole public life, both in Tasmania and then subsequently in Australia until his untimely death in 1939, was that unproductive debt was a drain on the economy through higher interest payments and higher taxes that ultimately fell upon workers. By 1922, Tasmania was paying a third of its revenue in interest on debts. The then Labor newspaper The World estimated that when Lyons became Premier of Tasmania in 1923, half of the government's revenue was being paid in interest. He had to draw on loan money just to pay the ordinary expenses of government. J.A. Hart summarises the achievement of Lyons as Premier of Tasmania within his first terms of office, and I quote, "Taxation was reduced and more equitably imposed.
loan expenditure reduced, all public service salary cuts restored, and the state shipping line, this is a recurring theme in Tasmania's history, established with Labor's approval in 1920 to provide transport to the mainland, was hastily sold, as it has proved an expensive liability. Although expenditure increased, the state of the economy improved, and in 1925, Lyons produced the first budget surplus in the state for years. But the reality was that by the early to mid-1920s, the seeds of the Great Depression were already growing. As the economic historian C.B. Shevden observed, the economy stagnated, real national product fell gradually, and product per head more rapidly, so that by 1927, well before the overseas collapse, Australia was already in a state of serious recession. And indeed, the economic and political storm clouds were already gathering on the horizon when Lyons, having retired from politics in Tasmania, was then sworn into the Australian Parliament in 1929. The new Scullin Labor government was confronted with a deteriorating financial crisis. For a decade, the Commonwealth and state governments had been reliant on overseas loans. The accumulated deficit was about 12% of the Commonwealth's revenue. Commodity prices were falling and unemployment growing at an alarming rate. UK credit was becoming more difficult to obtain as the banks in the old country gave preference to domestic requirements. Australia was already in a significant slump before the 1929 stock market crash, which signalled generally the Great Depression. The nation indeed faced a perfect storm of crippling debts compounded by a global credit crisis. By the early 1930s, the chairman of the Commonwealth Bank, in effect the Reserve Bank in those days, warned that it would be difficult just to meet the funds required to support the nation's debt and interest payments, leaving no further funds for any other purpose. The nation was in a dire situation as national income fell from £640 million to £560 million. And while Jim Scullin, Theodore and Lyons, the leaders then of the Commonwealth government, believed that the nation was living beyond its means and savings had to be made, other voices, as David has pointed out, particularly here in New South Wales, were advocating credit expansion. At the 1929 national elections, New South Wales swung significantly to Labor, with almost half of the new caucus from the state. The election the following year of the Lang government created an explosive situation. Although Scullin, a then Deputy Prime Minister Jim Fenton and Lyons, and at that stage Ted Theodore, had steadfastly rejected credit expansion and insisted that the nation had to pursue savings, including the reluctant decision to reduce wages and lay off public servants, the rampant Lang presented a new threat as he railed against the banks and called for the repudiation of the nation's loans. Now, as early as 1924, John Maynard Keynes had used Australia, and in particular New South Wales, to argue that the Dominions were able to borrow too cheaply resources which we, meaning the UK, can ill spare. But that warning went unheeded in the colonies. By the end of the decade, Australia's debt binge was exacerbated by the credit crisis of the Great Depression. It was a difficult situation for the new government, made worse by the political infighting from Lang and his supporters in the Federal Caucus. As David said, Prime Minister Scullin was out of the country for 5 months in 1930, something that could not be imagined today, attending the Imperial Conference in London, itself a very important object at the time. Ted Theodore, as David has outlined, was also sidelined while the investigation occurred into the collapsed mine in Queensland. And in the absence of Scullin and Theodore, Jim Fenton was the acting Prime Minister and Lyons became the acting Treasurer. The 1930 visit to Australia by Sir Otto Niemeyer, a representative of the London financiers, was the catalyst for the dramatic events that followed in 1931. For Scullin and Lyons, who knew that Australia would require more loans in the future to avoid bankruptcy, his message to the Premier's Conference in Melbourne to balance budgets and reduce national indebtedness was reassuring. And as David said, at the end of the meeting, a so-called Melbourne Agreement was reached, in which the governments, state and federal, decided to end borrowing and balance their accounts. This announcement had a very positive impact in London, the financial centre then as now of the globe. But a conference of unions and the ALP here in Sydney rejected the approach, called for a moratorium on interest payments, the repudiation of war debts, and the immediate financial stimulus for the economy. Lang and his supporters in the federal cabinet called for the repudiation of the Melbourne Agreement and credit expansion in the face of the request by Fenton and Lyons to put measures to the parliament for approval. Open warfare had broken out in cabinet and in the caucus. The radicals, led by Lang in New South Wales, were in the ascendancy and carried a motion at a marathon four-day caucus meeting to force the Commonwealth Bank to take up a $28 million pound loan, falling due in December. Even after hearing from the then Treasurer Lyons at length about the dire financial situation of the nation and the Nehemiah advice, they moved a motion to reject it. This, I submit, was a crisis in Australian politics that had never been experienced before in the history of the Commonwealth. On the second day, a motion was moved to force the Commonwealth Bank to take up the $28 million loan falling due in December, to which Lyons, as Treasurer, moved an amendment to reassert government policy. Even Theodore, who had returned to Parliament at that stage and who was locked in battle for the control of the New South Wales Labor Party, had abandoned his earlier support for savings. On the third day, as the nation waited with